This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. I'm your host, Lisa Pugh. Advocates for older adults in Wisconsin say that problems in the state's long-term care system require immediate attention as the population ages rapidly. Meanwhile, the nursing home industry says a new federal rule will have unintended consequences. We are joined today by the state's long-term care ombudsman, Kim Merhaini, and director of the ADRC of Brown County, Devin Christensen. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
I want to start by giving both of you the chance to talk a little bit about your work. Kim, I know you work for the Board on Aging and Long-Term Care. You're one of a team of ombudsmen in the state in the long-term care system. What is the role of an ombudsman?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Lisa. So we serve older adults age 60 and older who live in any licensed or certified long-term care setting in the state and who as well receive their home and community-based services through Family Care PACE and IRIS. We do individual advocacy, so we manage complaints or concerns by family members, by residents, by providers, by priests and pastors and friends, anybody in communities on behalf of a resident. And then we also advocate for systems change based on those trends that we see in those complaints and what we see in the general long-term care system.
Devin, I know you and Kim both have been working in the older adults community industry for decades. We don't need to age ourselves here. Yeah. And now you've been serving as the director of the ADRC of Brown County since 2012. Can you remind us what is the role of that statewide network of ADRCs?
Yeah, so aging and disability resource centers are really a Wisconsin idea, which is really exciting that made its way to the national level, and so there are ADRCs throughout the United States. But really as a Wisconsin idea was to create one-stop shop, a place to start for people to understand and get help navigating all the complexities in long-term care, but also to create access to long-term care programs and services. Whether somebody has resources they have to spend and we can help them spend it wisely, or people may be low income and need access to public benefits in order to gain access to those programs and services that will help support them. So a main role is for us to be individual advocates and educators with families as we help them make decisions, but then also system advocates, much like the Board on Aging and Long-Term Care. We work together often talking about system issues and helping to advocate for change that will work for people. I like to say a lot of times we're kind of the canary in the coal mine because we're boots on the ground. Families are coming to us looking for services, and if we cannot find them, there's a first tip that things are changing in the landscape. So we're always looking and advocating for an adequate service network.
When you talk about changing in the landscape, given the breadth of both of your experience, I'm wondering what you see as the biggest change in the state's long-term care systems in the last decade.
Yeah, I think there are so many. What I would probably identify first is just the change in our consumers today. That we see younger consumers coming into the long-term care system, maybe who've got disability needs or mental health needs that maybe weren't met in their younger years, and so the industry may not have kept up well in terms of how we train our staff to provide not just medical care, but person-centered, person-directed care that encompasses whole person. I think our systems haven't kept up. We see at the Board on Aging our complaints from 10 years ago. We used to call them cold coffee complaints or cold carrot complaints. My coffee is never warm. We get carrots too many times a week. Now our complaints really are about health, welfare, safety.
More critical needs.
Very critical needs, and some that are life-threatening. People not getting out of bed maybe over a weekend because there isn't enough staff in not just their nursing home, but their assisted living community as well. Or missing weddings and vacations and important social events.
Not putting emphasis on those social connections, maybe.
Correct.
even the last 10 years. Devin, would you agree? Do you see the same? And what is your kind of biggest change over the last decade?
So, I mean, I'd also agree that there's been a major shift as we advocated for this system to help people stay at home and have alternatives to institutional care. I mean, we really were strong and loud. And then we need to spend all of these years trying to improve those systems that need to keep up, just like what Kim is saying. I think we would say we've seen a shift in the acuity level in the different levels of care and the amount of types of care that might be
acuity
available.
Acuity level meaning complexity of care, how much care someone needs.
Somebody, if you go into a typical assisted living today, what you're seeing is somebody in my heyday you would have seen in a nursing home typically, the complex Hoyer lifts, Jerry chairs, tube feedings, things that maybe only a nursing home was handling, and then prior to that maybe a hospital. So now I would say hospitals have actually become part of the long-term care system as people struggle to find placements because those placement amounts and alternatives are shrinking and the complexity of people's care needs. The other thing I'd say is a major shift is caregiver support. So as a result, families are caring for their loved one at, we have this, right, this mythology that families don't care for their older families. That's not true at all. As a matter of fact, they are now an expected care partner. Yet we don't have policy or support for them to continue to do it. They have to provide complex care, not just bringing coffee and a few meals, but they're administering medications, they're doing very complex daily living skills or medical treatments at home.
Those are some pretty big changes just in the last decade. I know the Biden administration has said that they are now focusing more on some of these concerns that you just mentioned. In fact, they just this last April issued a federal rule that they had been working on. They said the rule that applies to nursing homes that receive federal funding was necessary, and this is a quote, because too many nursing homes chronically understaff their facilities, leading to substandard or unsafe care. Kim, would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, though I think the way the assessment is phrased, it makes it sound like it's intentional, and I'm not sure that that's always the case. Wisconsin has historically had an excellent reputation in the country and in the state for providing optimal care. And I was going to mention to Devin's other point, we also offer a plethora of options for care, not just a nursing home, but other ways of achieving independence through assisted living or home and community-based services. In our nursing homes, however, where we are today looks very much like we were in the 70s when Congress received so many complaints about the quality of care and what was happening to persons living in nursing homes that they started a pilot program for ombudsman programs. And Wisconsin was one of five.
So maybe we've taken a step backward?
Well, I'm drawn by the irony that where we were in the 70s is very much like we are today, but we look more toward regulation to fix that. I think the regulations have not kept up with the acuity that Devin talked about earlier. But then we also have to talk about funding as well. We have to talk about Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement. We have to talk about more positions for ombudsman programs for aging and disability resource centers to offer those supports.
Well, just to give our viewers an overview of what's in that rule and its intention, it will be phased in over the next several years. It requires all nursing homes that receive federal funding through Medicare and Medicaid to have 3.48 hours per resident per day of total staffing, including a defined number from both registered nurses and nurse aides. This means a facility with 100 residents would need at least two or three RNs and at least 10 or 11 nurse aides, as well as two additional nurse staff per shift to meet just the minimum staffing standards. The rule also requires facilities to have a registered nurse on site 24/7. The rule will be phased in, and there will be a temporary exemption process for facilities in workforce shortage areas. Kim, can you just summarize why was this rule necessary?
Well, again, I think quality of care. I think the rule also speaks to how we value long-term care systems and the persons who receive those services today. I talked earlier about the complexity of people who live in our long-term care settings and their needs and how the the lack of training and education for service providers, for example, hasn't kept up. Essentially, every aspect of nursing home regulation has been modified over the last several years. Staffing is the one area that hasn't been touched since, I believe, the 80s. And with the changes in complexity, with that lack of other supports being available, it only makes sense that we look to trying to bring maybe more value to that caregiver role to make sure that people want to be caregivers in long-term care, and then to compensate them fairly, not just by pay, but by benefits, by appreciation, by education. I always say value, appreciate, educate. Instead, I think we rely too much on rules to be the only answer, and I know the rules really are confounding for many providers who are wondering how
We've
they're going to meet
about
them.
That, right. Kim, can I ask you, I know as you're in your ombudsman role, you go directly into facilities and speak directly to those consumers. Help us understand, what does it look like when you go into a nursing home and they are understaffed? What does it look like for that consumer?
Those complaints are well documented by us as well as by the Division of Quality Assurance, and I imagine by Aging and Disability Resource Centers as well. The home may not be clean. It may have odors. It may have problems with bed bugs and cockroaches or issues with cold food. Residents tell us that, as I again mentioned before, maybe they don't get out of bed for a couple days at a time. Their medications might be late. Families tell us that maybe their family member has worn the same clothes for several days in a row. And to me, one of the most undignified things that we hear is residents being told that they could just wet themselves or soil themselves because it's easier for staff to change them in bed than it is to get them up and take them to the bathroom. So we hear more concerns about what we call excess disability, residents who are failing to thrive, they're becoming more incontinent, they're losing weight. There might not be enough staff to make sure that they get their meals, or the meals they get are the meals that they should have.
Devin, do some of these families end up at the ADRC asking for your help? Mm-hmm. How do you respond?
So we definitely are about connecting people to the right advocates. Certainly the ombudsman is one of those resources, but we also try to talk to people about being a good consumer, and we're also meeting with families before they make that choice. So one of our roles is to really help them explore where is a good facility, what do I know I'm looking for, when should I visit. So we talk a lot about go during meal times, don't go announced. You need to see things as not a planned tour where they try to just have everything be as they would like it to be, but the real day-to-day experience is very different. I guess I'd also like to say, much to Kim's point about this not being intentional, some of this is just basic demographics. Mm-hmm. We have a baby boom generation that is continuing to grow and will grow. The next 10 to 20 years, this is what we'll see. And a caregiver support ratio, the people available to do the care, is shrinking because of the generational differences. We have more older people.
We don't have enough workers.
We don't have enough people, period. And so try to convince fewer people to go into this line of work when you have a smaller pool to begin with. So we're going to see that through the next 10 to 15 years. So this isn't something that's going to be easily fixed with policy or just money. Years ago, we would say if people had a lot of resources, they had a lot of choices. That's not really the case. You can have a tremendous amount of resources, but the facilities or even home care cannot provide the service because they don't have the workers. And so that's really the shortage is impacting and trickling, and everybody is competing for that same person.
I know that Wisconsin is in better shape than a lot of other states when it comes to meeting at least the minimum requirements of this rule. The health policy research firm, the Kaiser Family Foundation, KFF, recently looked at Medicare Compare data. They say that 41% of Wisconsin nursing homes currently could meet the minimum standard, but compared to 19% nationally. So we're ahead there. KFF analyzed that Compare data from April 2024. In Wisconsin, they found that while 88% of facilities currently meet the registered nurse staffing requirement, only 42% meet that nurse aid ratio, and 41% meet all staffing requirements in the rule. Kim, you know a little bit about Wisconsin's preparation to meet this rule. What are they doing? What can we expect?
Yeah, I'm not at all thinking that this is easy for anyone, but I think, again, we have to look at how we value these caregiver roles, these partnership roles. What we hear from some nursing assistants, for example, is they love their job. They love serving people. They like working in nursing homes. What they don't always appreciate is that culture that maybe doesn't value them, that makes them feel like they're expendable, that is not fully about that resident's experience during their day.
But is the state working on that? Is there a way to work on that?
Yes. We are in many conversations today with the provider associations, with the regulating agency, with ADRCs, about how can we retool so that resident experience, because it is all about the resident, it should be all about the resident, that meets not just care and treatment concerns, but expectations for highest quality of care. Devin's point about how it isn't so much the case anymore that if you've got lots of money to spend, you could go anywhere you want to, is really well taken. We have seen closures, and I know that that's one of the issues that the associations might bring forward.
Closures of nursing homes.
Correct.
And record
correct.
Numbers.
But some of those, again, really are based on culture. It may be about that provider not putting the priority of the resident first, putting profits before that resident care. And there's much, much data out there about how these Medicare and Medicaid dollars and private pay dollars are used.
Kim, you mentioned profits there. Devin, I'm going to direct this question to you. Leading Age of Wisconsin, organization representing non-for-profit nursing homes, other assisted living facilities, and senior care providers, calls this rule an unfunded mandate. They say that it's low Medicaid reimbursement rates that are preventing them from staffing at the levels that they would like. Is that a valid concern, or is there some mix of profit margin here?
Well, that's the $10,000 question, right? The intention, and I think everyone, if you know, having worked with the industry as well, knowing that their intention is actually really good. Absolutely. They want to provide good quality of care. But just like all of our systems, when the dollars have not kept pace, that's a state and a federal issue, both, the reimbursement mix for people and facilities has changed to the point where folks with dementia who are going to live 10 to 15 years with those disease processes run out of money in two. So the balance of people who have high complex needs going into facilities who are on Medicaid or lower reimbursable amounts certainly impact their ability to provide that service. And they're not allowed to discriminate where some other industries are able to discriminate who they choose to have come to their facility. So I do think there's a tension about the money for sure, but there is also simply a shortage of workers. We have in our community have had 5 nursing homes close in the last year and a half, 2 years, and we will sit with a wing full of beds available, but families not be able to go there, but have to go counties away where we can find a place for them.
Because they can't staff those
empty beds.
Because
they can't staff the beds. It's not that the closures created less beds. It's having enough workers in those facilities to do it.
Do you expect the trend of nursing home closures to continue?
Probably until we find a way that the system can get rebalanced. And I guess to that point, what happens is there's tremendous pressure from the hospital systems who are spending a lot of resources, people sitting in beds that don't need that level of acuity, looking for a quick solution. And a quick solution creates impact everywhere else. So they're looking for nursing home relationships that they can pay to get people to go quickly into those facilities, which means people at home have less choices. So we create a system where acuity, a fall, a really difficult situation is what's going to bump people into those facilities quicker, while those folks at home, where it's cheaper for everyone to be, where people want to be, and where the majority of people live. We forget that 93% of all people are in the community, not in institutional care. So we have to focus energy
strengthening
there.
That part
it's
of the system.
It's not a you get or we get. It's we're all in this together in this large system, and it can't be competing for staff, competing for dollars, competing for residents.
That's a big problem to solve.
And I think there are opportunities there. You asked before, what can we do about this? And I, you know, part of the new mandate is for nursing homes to make better use of their facility assessment. And I'm hoping that that's more than a check-the-box kind of process, but instead, how can I find my niche? Maybe in this community, I can be that nursing home for persons with special needs, like those who are bariatric or who have a high fall risk or have kidney dysfunction, as compared to someone else who might do a great job serving persons with
dementia.
To
provide a more tailored type of care
in
their community.
So maybe downsizing our buildings. In Wisconsin, we've got many very old, very large buildings. So we do see a lot of buildings with empty wings.
What happens to a resident or to residents when a nursing home closes, Kim?
Yeah, we've in Wisconsin, we've got a really great program for closures. As unfortunate as that occurrence is, it's codified in statute for nursing homes and community-based residential facilities. Providers must submit a relocation plan. That plan is based on avoiding transfer trauma or relocation stress for that resident. It's an interdisciplinary approach that brings together the provider, the ADRC, the ombudsman program, area administration, adult protective services, everybody that might touch every resident.
Try to make sure we're not harming residents.
Yes, so that people move well, but that they also move well with all of their rights intact. That they're included in process decisions, that maybe they get to spend the night in the new place where they might go to live. And then we in the Ombudsman Program follow every resident for a period of time to make sure that move went well for them, that not only did their belongings come with them, but they've got a good match with a roommate, or they've got access to their community, to their family, or if that's not the right fit, how can we help them get back to where they really want to be?
Devin, you mentioned this a little bit, this kind of different types of settings, a setting that might look like a nursing home but isn't regulated like a nursing home. It's called an assisted living facility. I know this is confusing for a lot of people, but I know there's been some stories in the headlines in Brown County of one of these assisted living facilities deciding no longer to take Medicaid payments, Medicaid residents, and actually evicting those Medicaid-paying residents. Is that a trend then that is happening, and if so, why?
It goes back to your earlier question about reimbursement levels, right? And so as advocates, we are concerned that we would see facilities make that choice, who can make that choice, to say we're not going to take a managed care or a family care benefit. It's different than a straight Medicaid payment. Those are different funding amounts, and it gets very complicated. We won't get into those weeds, but they have a right to choose whether they would contract to do that kind of work. And so over time, they've seen those reimbursement levels be lower than what they can have for private pay. So the real issue is you might have a 90-year-old person who has saved $500,000 and goes into a facility and spends in 2 years all of their resources and now needs to go on to a long-term care program. And then they're asked to no longer live in that facility that they've called home.
Because that facility with private pay can control more of the income that's coming.
Correct.
In.
So they can choose who's going to be there and who's not. That's a trend that we're very concerned about, because the facilities who will receive those dollars will take a larger portion of those percentage of people in those facilities, which will begin to create, here's this beautiful facility that you're paying $10,000 a month to be in until you run out of money, and then here are these facilities that might be, you know, doing the best they can, but they have much lower reimbursement, so they can't have all of the buzzers and whistles as the other facilities do.
Is this part of what you call the have-not scenario?
Yes. And I think, you know, we visited that many years ago when we were looking at trying to advocate for a family care system or a change in long-term care where there were wait lists. Now we're just seeing a different type of have and have not, and a concerning trend. So hoping that we can intervene some way in public policy to make sure that we all share in this growing, again, demographics. The numbers are before us that we're going to have to face serving many, many people who will outlive their resources, even if they've been great savers and great workers. And at some point, $10,000 a month only goes so far.
I would also add that at one point, Wisconsin had a very high number of nursing home beds per population rate. And so Wisconsin all at one time as Family Care was developing, made a very conscious effort to try to move people into a less restrictive setting than a nursing home. And many of these assisted living options bloomed, the home and community-based services option.
Which was well-intended.
Which was
a good change.
All of this well-intended, certainly. And then, as Devin said, the demographics changed. And while those were predicted, we've been talking about those demographic switches for at least 10 years. The systems didn't change with them. But yet the focus remained on less restrictive, which is very much a legal term. And to that resident who now calls that maybe larger setting home, that for some people can be less restrictive than maybe a 4-bed adult family home where they don't have the space to move about or the peer group that really manages that social isolation need that people might have. So the solution to this is not simply funding. It really is multifactorial. We need to look at every aspect of infrastructure, and again, through that lens of the people that we serve.
I want to ask you, Devin, I know you do something unique with your strategic planning at your ADRC, something called foresight analysis, where you're really looking ahead rather than this point in time. How does that help you envision what the future could and should look like? We've talked a lot about the challenges we're facing today. How are you looking positively toward the future?
So foresight analysis, or some people would call it futuring. There's actually entire graduate programs around futuring, and it's not a crystal ball, which it sounds like, oh, we'll have this beautiful crystal ball and we'll know where we're going. What it is I engage my board members, staff, management team. We're all looking for trends and signals that we see along the way in what we're reading, what we're thinking about, what's coming up in primary articles, what we're seeing in the newspaper, what the calls that are coming in are like. And we begin to analyze what are we hearing and what trends do we need to pay attention to so that we can begin to build the future we hope for. So we call it a horizon thinking as well. So the third horizon is, what do we want to create? Horizon one is, where are we today? And then horizon two is the transitional work we need to do to build the future that we really want. We've been seeing this change in healthcare, like Kim mentioned, and the demographics for quite a while. We see our role as advocating with policy and systems to help elevate those voices, elevate what we're seeing, so that those trends that we're seeing around the have and the have-nots, the caregiver shortage issues, all of those that create tensions for families on the ground floor, to build policy around creating a better system in the future.
So what's the biggest ask in the next biennial budget for older adult advocates?
There are many. So with limited time, certainly the ADRC ask is a really important one, because just like all other policies, it's been a flat allocation from the beginning of time. And so all of our needs and expenses have gone up, and we want to be able to meet the needs of this growing population. And the other big ask is caregiver support, not just paid caregivers, which we will always advocate for, and great certification programs to get people easy access to those careers, but family caregivers, family leave. We have an Alzheimer's family caregiver program, a regular family caregiver program. Those folks need support today in terms of financial resources, but care, support groups.
We're going to be asking more of family caregivers.
We have to give them the tools they need in order to do the work that's being asked of them.
Kim, you've talked to me about how we need to be focusing more on the consumer voice in our planning, in our long-term care system. How do you think that putting more focus on a consumer voice, maybe rather than a provider voice, would change the way we create the future of long-term care?
Gosh, you know, the ultimate goal of an ombudsman program is to better equip consumers to be their own best self-advocates. So in our practice, we spend a lot of time helping people find their voice and to be able to feel comfortable exercising that without being afraid of retaliation or being discharged or being denied a service for having spoken up. So every opportunity that we have to be with a consumer or with a family, that's one of the things we saw come out of the pandemic. When people began to come to us with complaints, and I'll bet you saw this as well, Devin, they came very well prepared. They came with the nursing home regulation or the CBRF regulation. They came with federal rules. They came with information from other states about what other states were doing maybe to minimize social isolation. And so I think if we can find those vehicles to give consumers their voice in a way that helps policymakers and funders hear that, then we can fund not just programs with all of our individual agencies, but we fund people. We listen to what that consumer expects, not just now, but in the future, what we might expect as consumers in the future. And I guess not just what we expect, but what as citizens do we really deserve for best care?
All right, that will be the final word. This has been a great conversation. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to the viewers of Newsmakers. Be sure to tune in again as we highlight the issues and sit down with the decision makers who make a difference for all of us.
You have been watching a production of Wisconsin Eye, your unfiltered window into legislative deliberations and public policy programming, where our mission is to provide Wisconsinites an opportunity to access the legislative process and connect with conversations that inform our citizenry. Please consider supporting our mission, and thank you for watching. Wisconsin Eye, policy made public.